This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by Go Engineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit theuavdigest.com/goengineer. And by UAV Propulsion Tech, a provider of propulsion, servo, autopilots, and rescue and recovery parachute solutions for the unmanned aerial vehicle market. For more information, check out www.uavpropulsiontech.com. You're listening to episode 173 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Good evening, Max. How are we?
David, doing well, doing very well. And we have kind of a special segment this episode, an interview that our friend Tim Trott recorded for us.
And it is with Larry Friese, who is the president of Aerial Information Systems. So we're going to play that first, and then we're going to go on to a little bit of listener news because, you know, we don't like this show to run any longer than 30 minutes. And, of course, in the listener news, we'll have it's that time of the year. In the next couple of episodes, I'm sure we're going to have a list of something. And our second favorite Connecticut Yankee is in the news again, our first being my co-host. And, of course, we have feedback, and we're sort of mixing the feedback with the videos, which is a good way to get our listeners to encourage them to send in the videos because they get to kill two birds with one stone. So I guess we should get started. You want to introduce the interview?
Sure. Again, it's something that Tim Trott recorded. Tim, of course, is from Southern Helicam, and the interview with Larry Friese was recorded at the inaugural Emerald Coast Unmanned Systems Business Expo. That was in Pensacola on Saturday, November 19th, 2016. And yes, Larry is president of Aerial Information Systems Corporation, and he was speaking at the expo on the topic of preparing for counter UAS technology. So here's the conversation with Tim and Larry.
I'm Larry Friese from Aerial Information Systems Corporation, and I work counter UAVs, or UAS, from a red team perspective. It means I play the aggressor. What we do is, you look at a lot of counter UAS applications right now, they're kind of aimed for the low-hanging fruit, the DJI Phantoms and stuff like that, the ones that were, a whole bunch of them really are out there in the ecosystem now. What I do is go kind of the next step beyond. I start looking at, well, how we look at the DJI Phantoms, but also look at, well, how does, if I do an aftermarket mod to one, or if I do a DIY build, and then I put it in the hands of, say, ISIS or Al-Qaeda, what can we do with it? So what we do is I include not just the technology, but also the actors involved in it, because if we look at ISIS, for instance, their use of drones over the last year has been actually pretty dramatic. It started out as just basic surveillance drones, and now in the last couple of months we found out that they're actually building their own, down to possibly the avionics level, which is very scary. So what I try to do is, I'm an engineer, and my background is intelligence and threat systems and aerial targets, of being able to say, you know, go through and do the legwork for a lot of people of, you know, how am I going to hack a drone? Why would I do it? And then how would I use it? What kind of different scenarios? So what I do is I spend my day most of the time now of looking at the dark side of how would I attack in a stadium full of people? What were the different scenarios I would use? And then we'll also spend quite a bit of time of all these UAS defenses that are coming online, of where are their vulnerabilities at? And each different technology, even down to the system level of targeting companies now, of, you know, how would I beat that specific system?
If they use off-the-shelf stuff, it's easier to detect if they're using 2.4 meg or gig or 5.8 gig. But if they go outside that realm into something in another frequency you don't expect. So you've got two aspects of it. You've got the command and control aspect of it, you know, the radio control of it, plus you've got the physical, because there was a device that I saw that was looking for, basically a radar looking for physical. But that gets very difficult when you get down to these 250-ounce things that you can put a very, very lot of damaging materials in something on a very small package. That can be really challenging to you.
Yeah, exactly. Because, yeah, like I said, because a lot of these guys, they're looking at that low-hanging fruit, which is a very valid concern, because that's for the reckless users, people flying into the airports or, you know, open air events and stuff like that. Very valid concern, but it's once we start hitting a countermeasures loop, which I don't think we're there yet, but we don't know when we're going to be there. You know, it could be tomorrow. We could be in it right now with ISIS or Al-Qaeda, or for who knows? I mean, because this technology is, you know, so widely proliferated that we don't know where the next one's coming. And now I look outside of terrorism too. We look at, you know, smuggling, using the drug cartels to haul drugs across the border, haul stuff into prisons. Look at espionage. We've already seen instances of espionage, drones being used for industrial espionage. So, you know, doing a surveillance mission for a drone is actually a lot harder than doing, say, like a strike mission. Because when you're talking about, well, if I've got a detection system out looking for those signals, well, you know, with a surveillance system, I've got to have my camera or whatever. It's got to be broadcasting for me to use it. And so, you know, a counter UAS system has a better chance of finding somebody who's doing surveillance against them. Strike missions, on the other hand, that's where we're probably the absolute weakest at, because I don't need a radio. I don't need a data link for it. And then I start going after, you know, once I get those little nuisance, you know, off my ankles, then I start looking at how do I beat the radars, the thermal sensors, and stuff like that. And that small size is a killer.
I was going to say, what are your modes of detection? I can think radio, I can see it, radar, but what are your other modes?
Radar and thermal are the first big ones from an adversary's perspective that keep me up at night trying to figure out how to beat. The radio detection, typical cameras, I mean, EO camera, you have to have something that's very, very high resolution in order to detect, you know, get it way off. They look at acoustic. You know, there are several acoustic systems on the market. Problem with acoustic is a very short range. If probably anybody's flown quadcopters knows that, you know, a Phantom's pretty loud. You can hear it for maybe about 500 to 700 feet out. But my buddy's got a unique Q500, and that thing is about dead quiet at 300 feet.
And you got the difference, too, because the difference between a DJI and, like, for example, an Autel, I mean, they're totally different sounds.
Yeah, exactly. Where I do a lot of test range, I mean, it's dead silent, so we can pick it up. You get into an industrial area, I don't think the things are going to work very well. I mean, even if they're trying to do signature analysis and stuff like that. What I find about UAS defenses is you just can't pick one. You got to have an onion. You know, you ideally want a radar. Problem with radars is they're expensive. So, you know, not everybody's going to be able to afford them, or you're not able to install them. So if you can't get a radar, then you want to go with the multi-sensor system, where you want to do thermal, you want to do EO, you probably want to do acoustic.
Where does AI come into this?
AI, that is on the top of my threat list right now, and it's the top of people that I'm trying to sell my services to. They're very, very interested in AI. Because it's the whole idea is what we're doing as an industry of trying to make airplanes easier to fly. Well, that benefits the bad guys too, you know. And so the easier we take it, and that stuff gets passed on, the easier it's going to be for those guys to use them.
That's one way to look at AI. I was looking at it the other way, because using something like face recognition to recognize and identify a drone, doing the same type of technology into acoustics.
Actually, they are. I understand some people are doing that, especially on the acoustic side and on the imaging side of being able to recognize things. Now, you have to look at acoustic might be a little bit easier once it gets in range, because each one of these planes is going to have a particular, you know, signature. If you do a spectrogram of like a Phantom versus a Unique, you can tell the difference on a spectrogram.
And then you got to build an index.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what they're doing. I mean, the companies for like RF detection, you know, they don't look necessarily. They look at where I'm getting activity within the frequency bands, but they are looking at different specific channels, because you can take DJI, you know, can't, if you go in and look at it, they do have, you know, certain designs that, certain ways they use the externals of the signal that can tell you it's probably a DJI.
Well, it kind of complicates when you have things like spread spectrum, and you can have five or six on the same channel. Like who's the good, who's the friendly, who's not?
Exactly, and that becomes in that identification phase. And this is why it's detection's actually the easiest. I mean, you look at a typical, how do I defend against a drone? It's, you know, detect,
the analyzation,
yeah, you know, identify and then defeat. Detect's actually the easiest. The more you get around to defeat, the harder it's getting, because once I see this drone, especially as we get more drones flying, the ID is going to become hard.
And the time factor, because you've got to make a decision.
You've got to make a decision. And part of that identification, one sub factor, you know, sub part of that is deciding. And you need to know your rules of engagement immediately. You need to know where you stand legally and liability wise, because that drone may not be a threat. It may be somebody else's drone that just innocently strayed over. And then, you know, we look in the defeat mechanisms. I mean, look, the defeat mechanism, technically, some of them are illegal. You can't jam. That's it. Only the government can jam.
And you can't drop it on the public.
Yeah, you can't shoot it because that's interfering
with
an
aircraft.
Exactly. FAA kind of bit them a little bit there. Depends on how you look at it. But
an aircraft isn't. As soon as you define it as an aircraft for regulation, then the rest of it comes with it. So you get the bottle, you get the baby.
Exactly. And so somebody's going to have to reconcile that. Of, you know, how, not necessarily the government, because the, you know, obviously law enforcement, military, you know, somebody like DHS can pretty much do whatever they want to do, because they can turn around justify it. But how do you go and tell Valero Oil or, you know, ExxonMobil or something like that, okay, great, hey, great, you got a drone defense system now over your, you know, multi-billion-dollar refinery that's a big target. Well, what happens if you find a drone? What do? I mean, do you...
Nuclear facility, you got so many other targets.
Yeah, you know, do you deputize these guys? I don't know. That's why I don't want to work on the defense side. I like working on the red team. I just cause the problems. I don't try to figure out how to solve them. But there are some defeat mechanisms that, you know, you can... Depends on where you're at. I mean, if you're looking... If you got a terrorist coming in, that's a different problem. But if you're a private company or something like that and you're trying to protect some IP or something like that, you know, detection may be the only thing you need, because at that point you don't care about the ID. If I detect a drone over and I've got something that I'm trying to protect that's outside, cover it up. Simple as that. It really, really, really depends on the application of, you know, how problematic the rest of that defense process gets.
What are your potential trajectories? I mean, can you take over command and control? Do you do it as like fencing? What are your and you can't shoot it down. So what are your options?
Well, I mean, some companies do claim to have protocol injection, because the question is whether or not that's legal. Because it is interfering with the aircraft.
One that I saw was it can automate the home function. It can intercede and it can make it go back to where it came from.
Right. Like, for instance, a lot of the drones, especially that use more of the open source software like PixHawks or those are software. I mean, it all depend on Mavlink as the data protocol for the data link, which is wide open. Everybody knows it. So at that point, your only protection is if you encrypt the data link. So if they use encryption, you can't. I mean, that's obviously can't get in the data link at that point. If you can get in the data link, then you can hit the auto home. I can hit the land, you know, land immediately or something like that. That may be fine for DJI, where they understand that it's been in a controlled environment of, you know, of testing environment. I know
DJI doesn't use Mavlink, so
yeah, but
they're on their own proprietary.
Yeah, but they've evidently been penetrated, because some companies are claiming they can do it. Once we get outside of that, I mean, that's where I'm saying where we're hitting the low-hanging fruit versus hitting everybody else. Because if we get a threat, because once we get into the countermeasure loop of like Al-Qaeda, ISIS, drug cartels, whoever it may be, start seeing that, hey, I can't use DJI, I can't use an Inspire 2 because the government's going to be all over that. Mm-hmm. So the next step is going out and getting a PixHawk, downloading, you know, ArduPilot or something, and taking and but they're still kind of exposed with Mavlink, but it depends on how sophisticated they are. And, you know, if, especially if the drug cartels, I mean, they have a lot of money, and if they can go through and actually go hire somebody, they could go in and, you know, what I would recommend if I, you know, like I said, I'm playing the adversary role here, is I'm going to encrypt the data link, number one, the best I can, and then I'm going to make sure I put a second layer of protection in there. I'm going to get rid of Mavlink, and then I'm going to try to put some way to...
But in some ways, that makes your job easier, because if the command and control is encoded, there's no good reason to encode it other than...
Well, what
that's a detection in itself.
See, this is what I'm saying. If I'm playing the defender, it's one thing, but as an adversary, you know, I want multi-layers of protection. Because what we found out, like Zigbee, there was a hardware exploit that somebody found that you could get around the encryption. So I don't know if, you know, what the government resources are putting on to these radios to try to find exploits like that. So what I kind of assume the worst case scenario is if I got encryption, I'm going to use it. But once I get down into the data link itself, I'm going to play around with that protocol. I'm not going to make it easy for them. I might put fake packets in there. And then when the autopilot, you know, I may put something that's a keep alive type thing. That way,
decoys and everything.
Exactly,
else.
Decoys. Because from an adversary's perspective, my number one thing I use is deception. And that's where every one of the counter defense systems.
And misdirection.
Exactly. I mean, every one of the systems, even the radar. The radar, like I said, is the hardest thing to beat. Because, and what they're doing, these guys are tuning in now to these small targets. In the past, most of the military-grade radars and stuff, they filtered out the clutter. I mean, with small UAVs flying low, that's clutter.
Well, I was going to look at the AI part of it. You can use that to discern between a drone and a bird, for example. The bird has a defined mode of operation.
I got a tactic for that, but I'm not going to share it.
Yeah, okay. Got to know where to stop.
Yeah, and that's what I do is trying to stay a few steps ahead. Not because then what we can do is go back to the manufacturers or the users and say, hey, we found this vulnerability, you might want to go fix it. The same way cybersecurity works. Because, I mean, especially on the drones, I mean, they're, for all intents and computers, you know, flying networks now. So they have so much in common with just standard cybersecurity. So, you know, I'm looking, you know, I'll practice as an adversary the same type of things that anybody else would do, protecting their Wi-Fi and then deceiving people as much as I can. Because that's what I'm saying, a lot of the companies I don't think need to include, and I don't know if it's necessarily their fault about including actors in, because they don't know exactly who the actors are. But that's what we red team for, is to try to say, well, if we don't know who an actor is, we're going to put in a, you know, distribution of actors that might fall down in that range, and that's, you know, who you should be aiming to be able to defend against. And, you know, we're going to play games like that, you know, like a Phantom. Okay, you're going to go up there and say, I'll give the defense plenty of credit that they can detect my Phantom, they can do protocol injection. I've got a couple tactics for them. I think I can still get past them. So that's why I think this is why I push the red.
Keep them guessing.
Exactly. Keep them guessing. Keep them confused.
Thank you, Larry. Appreciate it.
Sure thing.
Well, Max, that was pretty cool. You know me, I like aggressors and adversaries, and I'm always for the Red Force when they're fighting the Blues. Interesting that we have a UAV operator pretending to be a bad guy and working on counter UAS. You know, it seems like every episode we talk more and more about counter UAS as much as UAS.
Yes, that seems to be true. And, you know, I have to say, I think Larry's got the better side of this little research project. He's got the more fun side of it anyway, I think. So that's great. We can just mention that Aerial Information Systems, AIS, it's interesting. It's a minority woman-owned full-service geographic information systems production and environmental small business. And they provide multidisciplinary databases for use in GIS and environmental and urban planning, as well as facilities management. And I think we can go ahead and mention their website, which is www.aisgis.com. So you can take a look at them. And, of course, Tim Trott is from Southern Helicam. That's his website also, southernhelicam.com. He provides aerial photography and video services. But also, Tim is very active in sort of the area of development of UAS and regulations and so forth. And so he has a lot of information on his website, in his blog, in this UAS space. So be sure to check that out.
So I guess we should do a little bit of news. What do you think, Max?
Okay. What do we got? We have some interesting stories, though.
Very interesting. And the first one I actually thought was really interesting was we talked about GoPro recalling their drones. And then the consumerreports.org came up with the whose responsibility is it to usher in the recall or order the recall? The FAA doesn't normally recall aircraft, do they?
No, and there is an organization that's called the Consumer Product Safety Commission, the CPSC. And that's the organization in the United States, anyway, that I guess you'd say manages or handles product recalls. They have processes for doing that. This is sort of the official way that recalls are handled. Well, now we have GoPro, as I think most of you listening know, has pulled back its Karma drones. They have some kind of a problem with some number of them losing power, apparently, and coming down. GoPro did the right thing and said, okay, we have a problem. We've got to get these off the market. And so they contacted the FAA. The FAA, as you know, you mentioned, David, didn't feel like they had jurisdiction. GoPro contacted the CPSC, and they said they don't have jurisdiction over drones.
It's an airplane.
It's an airplane.
This is one of those you'd never really realize it until it happens kind of moments, you know, that we've talked about these sort of black holes that you don't know exist until they suddenly appear. This is really one of those, okay, somebody's got to figure this out, because imagine if suddenly a DJI Phantoms were dropping out of the sky, the thousands of them. I mean, when you have a consumer safety recall for like an automobile, it's usually thousands, you know, or sometimes hundreds of thousands of people who have to get notified, and somebody's got to manage that. In this case, is this a good use of the registration system? How do you get the recall information out to the people who bought them?
Yeah, it's a tough problem. I mean, we're dealing with a new product category here. And, you know, as we're trying to, we being collectively the government, industry, and the consumers, are trying to figure out what the rules should be. And as we know, we have some of them, and there's more that need to be developed. But it's kind of impossible to think in advance of all the little aspects of this new product category that could become important. And one of these is, what happens when you have a recall? And there is no process for that right now. So, yeah, it's got to be developed. The question here, David, is who is in charge of figuring this out? I don't know.
Right. And another way is who's in charge of figuring it out, and who's going to actually sit down to figure out what they don't know they don't know?
Right.
You know, this is one of those, okay. And let's be fair, GoPro was doing the right thing. And it's like, oh, okay. Well, I don't do that. You do that. Well, I don't do that either. So it's unfortunate circumstances for GoPro, but it's a real learning curve that we've got a lot of things. It's a consumer market, you know, and washing machines fail and televisions fail and cribs fail. And we have this whole infrastructure set up for consumer safety protection. And in this case, it sort of failed because we had something that it wasn't ever expecting to fail. So
I don't know what the answer is, but it does seem more like a consumer product than an airplane. To me, at least when we're talking about, you know, small UAS. And since the CPSC already has most of what I think we would need in place, I don't know. My initial thought is it should be organized through that organization. But I don't know. I guess smarter minds need to think about this and come up with an answer.
If it was a hoverboard, it would be easy.
Yeah.
It's December here when we're recording this, and 2016 has sort of blown by. I'm not sure really what happened to it, but it's pretty much gone. And this is that time of year again when we come up with lists. They're either lists about what's happened this year, or in this case, it's four things to watch in the UAS space next year, which would be 2017 as we record this. And this was from xyht.com. The first one is dealing with regulation, and we need BVLOS, Beyond Visual Line of Sight.
I think that's the big one. I think that's the real big one that is sort of holding up progress or limiting the forward progress of the industry beyond virtual line of sight. Maybe another one is flights over people, but that seems to be coming along at the FAA. But beyond visual line of sight, I mean, obviously you need that for package delivery, for any kind of long distance flights. And this is a tough one to crack. I agree with this organization, this magazine, XYHT, that this is definitely one of the things to watch for in 2017.
And I think you need to explain what XYHT is.
It's one of those things. I don't know if there's a way to pronounce that, or they just say XYHT. But basically, it's a magazine and a blog that covers geospatial disciplines, both for professional and prosumers, they call it. So what's XYHT? Well, it signifies the set of coordinates, they say. X is left, right. Y is fore, aft. H is up, down, or orthometric height. And T is time, I guess. So that's where they come up with the name for their magazine and blog. So it's interesting. They've got a lot of interesting content there. I think it's worth all of us taking a look at. But regulation was number one of the four things to watch for. The second one is direct georeferencing. Now, this one sort of gets a little bit out of my my expertise, I guess.
Well, you're the engineer. So you're throwing it over to the historian to figure it out, huh?
All right. Well, I can say what they said. They said it's what to watch for is UAS mapping without ground control points. This can be done with RTK or PPK, like SenseFly's EB+, or by incorporating GNSS, INS, IMU solution into the UAS, like Micro Drones does with their MD Mapper 3000DG. That's something to watch for, direct geo-referencing. That's number two in the list.
Number three is UAS-borne LiDAR.
Mm.
Their comments were they need affordable solutions for LiDAR, and the yields increased accuracy and produced processing time. This is going back to our favorite subject that we finally got a guest on about, which is LiDAR is precision agriculture, you know, and that's vitally important. I think they should also add weight. I know that the LiDAR seem to be heavier and larger than other sensor suites. That's one of those, like beyond visual line of sight, is a key to where commercial applications will come in, and precision agriculture being the number one. And the next one I kind of like, which is hybrid fixed-wing multi-rotor platforms, i.e. the best of both worlds.
And they note that we're seeing more of those in operation and available. It makes kind of sense. You need sometimes the vertical takeoff capabilities of a multi-rotor. You don't need a runway or some kind of a launching device. And the downside of a multi-rotor, of course, being that it's a hugely inefficient means of generating aerodynamic lift. Fixed wing, of course, is much more efficient, so that you therefore get much longer flight times. So some combination craft, I think, in many applications is just kind of what you need.
And that just means we're going back to the 50s.
with vertical, you know, with pogos and and actually the DARPA TERN program, T-E-R-N, if you look at their latest concept, it's a flying wing with a contra-rotating propellers on the top. It's a tail sitter. It sits on its tail, takes off, converts to vertical flight, and then returns to... And the nice thing about tail sitters, the hard part was when we used them in the 50s with men in them, taking off was easy. Backing on the ground and not being able to see behind you or underneath you as you're landing on your tail was the real challenge. When you have an unmanned aerial vehicle, you don't need to worry about that. Hmm. So I'm sure we're going to see a lot of hybrid vehicles, and it's the, like they say, the best of both worlds. You may lose a little in inefficiencies either way, but I think the rewards outweigh the problems. And let's look at things like V-22 tilt rotors. I mean, that's the same process. You know, the rotors move forward for high-speed flight and better lift using the wing, but it can take off and land in vertical or hover, which is the other aspect of the quad rotor. So four things to watch. One of those things, we probably should tag this for December of next year, Max.
Yes.
Let's see if we actually did see any of this. So let's talk about our favorite state of the union, Connecticut. You know, I have to keep bringing this up because you keep bringing up Gustav Whitehead. So for every,
so this is payback, huh?
This is payback. And for all of those people who don't listen to Airplane Geeks, Connecticut has declared that the Wright brothers were not the first people to fly a in controlled flight, but Gustav Whitehead was. Their Senate and House of Representatives sent a letter, and their governor approved it. Well, I mean, we all know that that's wrong, but except Max.
What do you mean, we all? All right, well, let's get back to this student from who happens to be in Connecticut. So this is we've talked about the videos. You've probably seen them. This is the student who weaponized a quadcopter, put a quote flamethrower on another, has been involved in several different things. So there are a number of different court cases concerning this individual.
It really is kind of impressive the width and breadth of legal ramifications he's gone through.
Yeah, well, one of them is that the FAA requested certain information concerning any monetary gains that he may have gotten from his videos.
YouTube videos.
He and his father refused to provide that, so that's open. You can understand why the FAA wants that, or at least it would seem that if there was some profit made from the videos, then maybe that's a commercial use, and then maybe now the activities fall under FAA jurisdiction. There's an unrelated case concerning some hanky-panky that this kid was allegedly involved in. I won't go into that too much. But the third one, and the topic of this ABC News report, is that his school, Central Connecticut State University, threw him out. And so there was a case against that claiming...
Wrongful expulsion.
Wrongful expulsion. That's it. And a Superior Court judge dismissed the lawsuit. Now they plan to appeal it, but his school says no thanks, and so the thing continues. So
part of the expulsion was the fact that his original claims were he was doing this under the direction of his engineering teacher at the university. You know, the flamethrower and the gun things were, these were engineering experiments for the university, and the university subsequently said no, they weren't. So that's caused the expulsion. So I'm sure in 2017 Austin will come back again, but let's move on to some better things and better people, like our listeners and their feedback.
We heard from Patrick. He wrote us and suggested that we take a look at the Intel 500. Now, we've talked about Intel in the past and their efforts to, well, really set world records in terms of number of drones flying in a coordinated swarm. They had set the record at 100, and they've moved on to 500. And as Patrick says, all you got to do is go over to YouTube and just search for Intel 500, and you'll find some of them. There's one video in particular we'll put into the show notes that I think this is spectacular. You know, David, when I first heard people saying, hey, maybe, you know, this kind of night flying by swarms of drones with colored lights will replace fireworks, I thought, well, there's no way. It's just fireworks are just so much more spectacular than a bunch of lights floating around. But I don't know. When I watch this video, man, this is really impressive. This looks really, really good.
Well, you know, if Disney wants to do it, there's got to be something to it. Yes, this video is pretty awesome. And the fact that it's 500 individual drones is pretty phenomenal. While we do say you can Google Intel 500, you're probably better off going to the UAVDigest.com and look at this one and enjoy it. And I guess, Max, you're right. I'd love to hear from our listeners if they actually think this is going to replace fireworks. Are we going to see the Hudson River covered with drones someday on 4th of July?
What strikes me is, besides just the sort of grandeur and the amazing show that these drones put on, apart from that, it makes you think about what's got to be behind that in terms of controlling these things. It's got to be just something phenomenal that is going to have applications, I think, in other areas that maybe we can think of some of them, maybe we can't yet.
Do they go bump, 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 or whatever the music is that starts an Intel processor?
No. No, well, I don't know. Maybe they do.
So, a very cool video. And we got another video. This was from Luke. Hey there, my friend and I made a recent very unique type of drone video and something I think you'd like. And of course, anytime someone sends their own drone videos, we really like it. And this was a Cape Town selfie. And we'll put links to this YouTube video in our show notes. What did you think, Max? Is it a cool selfie or what?
It's great. And it's a series of them. And it really shows, you know, not only the subjects of the selfie, but the way that it depicts the surrounding environment there in Cape Town, I think, is really effective.
And selfie means the town and the people. It's not just a droney, you know, where the drone takes a picture of this person. It pans out, and it's a really cool video. And Luke, thank you for sending it to us. We appreciate it.
All right. Well, I think that's it for this episode of the UAV Digest. You can find us, as always, at theuavdigest.com. You can go to the show notes for this episode directly at theuavdigest.com/173.
And of course, we have all sorts of social media presence. Our partial one, and that's growing, and really interesting conversations, of course, is our Slack listener team. And you can find out about that at theuavdigest.com/team. Or if you want to join, you can send us, Max or I, an email to feedback@theuavdigest.com. Of course, there's other ways to get a hold of us, which is at the UAV Digest on Twitter or facebook.com/UAV Digest. And if you want to reach Max or I, we have our own emails, which is david@theuavdigest.com or max@theuavdigest.com. You can get some swag at our Cafe Press store. And of course, you can become a patron of the show at patreon.com/theuavdigest. And if you really want, you can go to our homepage, which is theuavdigest.com. Check out the links of all of our media partners for the conventions and all of those links to our videos and show notes. So I guess all of that, you've got a lot of homework to do for next week, folks. So this is David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
Thanks for listening.